Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When the labor market tightens up, opportunities tend to open up for largely marginalized groups, and that includes people who are disabled. But in Ohio, at least, the workforce still lags when it comes to employing people with disabilities. We're talking about why the gap still exists to that extent, despite the promise of the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. Mary Dale Walters is Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications for Illinois-based ALSEP Employment Services. It's an employment network funded by the Social Security Administration to help people find jobs. Mary Dale Walters joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Why the relationship with the Social Security Administration?
The administration is charged with administering a number of work incentive programs to assist people who are on benefits in going back to work if they can once they are on those benefits.
Is there any sense about what the numbers are when it comes to people on benefits that could work if they could find the right kind of job?
It's a really broad estimate. There are various studies that estimate anywhere between 5 and 18% of people who are currently on benefits could possibly go back to work and get off of benefits.
Why is finding employment for people who are disabled such a challenge? Is it just sort of, for starters, just having that one category of disability? There's a lot of, it's very complicated, right?
It is very complicated. You have physical and mental disabilities. You have barriers such as transportation, childcare, just the emotional ability to recommit to a job. And fundamentally, what lurks very front and center in these people's heads is, what happens if I try to go back to work and I can't and I lose my benefits? Then I don't have any options before me.
What is the larger national goal? What are we shooting for? What's the expectation?
Social Security sets goals as far as participants in their primary program, which is called the Ticket to Work program, but it's a very small percentage of people. And in fact, many believe the agency doesn't do enough work toward escalating the importance of its work incentive programs within the agency and reaching out to people outside the agency. So this year, maybe in the past year, about 71,000 people joined the Ticket to Work program. There are a little over 300,000 people participating in the different work incentive programs around the country.
Are there lots of incentive programs around the country?
There are lots of incentive programs run by state and local organizations. There are a couple primary ones that are at that federal level with Social Security, and that includes the Ticket to Work program, which is a program that kind of puts you over in a special track. It protects your benefits. It lets you try to go back to work. It ensures your benefits are maintained for a certain amount of time before you would have to go off of those benefits. They also have work incentive counselors. They do find through their research that people who have special assistance in counseling and coordinating their benefits and going back to work will be more successful at going back to work. They also fund through the Department of Labor state vocational rehab agencies, including the one in Ohio, which has lots of different programs for helping people get reskilled, assessed for their skills, and then go back to work.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about employing people who are disabled. Just about 4 in 10 people who are disabled are in the workforce from that primary working age group. That's compared to nearly 8 out of 10 overall in the country. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear from people who are disabled in one way or another, and talk about how you found a job or how you found a good fit for yourself. My guest is Mary Dale Walters. She's Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications for Illinois-based ALSEP Employment Services. That's an employment network funded by the Social Security Administration to help people across the country and in Ohio find jobs. Mary, when I talk about expectations, I guess, how do we measure what somebody should expect to be employed at, given their disability? Is it the world is their oyster? Anything goes. It can be overcome if you just try hard enough. Or when you talk about having counseling people who help counsel with vocational rehabilitation and that sort of thing, what is their universe?
The universe we find is as broad as the individual wants to perceive it as. We find that a lot of the desire to go back to work one day, if they're headed toward benefits, if they've applied for Social Security disability insurance, 52% of them tell also that, I really would like to go back to work. But they're going to spend about the next anywhere from 4 months to 3 years trying to get those benefits. And they begin to feel uncomfortable with the idea that they're going to express a desire to work when they're being assessed against their ability to work because of their disability. So they get really beaten down by that process. And Social Security really doesn't talk to you about maybe going back to work until after that three-year trek is over and your benefits have started. And then they start talking about, well, maybe you can go back to work.
Why is that? Why do they wait till then?
It's just part of their process. And we think ALSEP is part of a coalition called the Secure Work Coalition, and it's disability organizations as well as other employment networks. And we're working with Congress and Social Security to try to raise awareness of how to improve the program. And one of those improvements is to talk about Social Security disability from the very beginning as a potential short-term safety net. One of the characteristics of or requirements of the program is you have to prove that you aren't going to be able to work for 1 year or more. There are many people that we find who have a cancer, for example. They're diagnosed with cancer. They can't work. Their chemotherapy, their treatment, their drug regimens make it impossible for them to work. They beat their cancer. They're 2, 3, 4 years down the line from when they were first diagnosed. They're on benefits. And they think they can go back to work. In answer to the other part of your question, employers and individuals looking for work have to begin to think about work in a slightly different way. Do you insist that you're still an airline pilot when you can't be an airline pilot anymore? What other skills do you have that you can transfer to another area of working for an airline or working in the aviation industry? Employers have to think differently about people with disabilities. Does that job really have to lift 50 pounds? Does that job really have to function in a building that you own that's part of your setting? Can that person work from home? And the big umbrella around all of this is, do both sides of the aisle really understand the American Disabilities Act and how to accommodate those workers?
And you think not?
We see surveys that say that perhaps employers aren't always on the mark with their understanding and more important, their application of the ADA. I don't think workers in general plan to go off and be hurt or disabled, so they really don't understand what those characteristics of the ADA and opportunities they provide for them. There's a perception that it's expensive to adapt for a worker with a physical disability, for example, but I think the average cost is really maybe $500. There are work incentive credits for employers who hire certain types of people with disabilities so they can defray those costs. Under the Ticket to Work program for the worker, you can get credit for some of the expenses you had to go back to work, and they take that off of the perceived earnings that you're getting from your new job when they're calculating how much of your benefit you're still going to get. So there's lots of little pieces out there, but nobody really does a great job of pulling it all together and fostering that person from the point of disability all the way through benefits and then out the other side on benefits.
Is there a breakdown, and is it worth talking about a breakdown between people in that large category of disabled who are disabled for most of their lives for one reason or another versus those who are injured on the job or injured outside as an adult?
There are two types of disability programs in the federal system. One is the SSI program, which is funded by general taxpayer revenue. Typically, you find, for example, young adults with developmental disorders, and they've moved through that SSI program, and when they become adults, there's frequently a lot of programs locally and at a state level to assist those young adults into transitioning for the first time into work. So there are lots of programs out there for those young adults who spend their life with a type of disability that's going to affect their ability and the type of jobs they can have. Mm-hmm. For Social Security disability, which is the worker disability. These people have 20 to 30 years of work experience. The average age is 54 for somebody who's on disability benefits. So it's a different profile. And those are the people who have a lot to bring back in particular into the work. They have all this work history that they can bring back. We find a lot of people lose track of their former employer. And our employment network, ALSEP Employment Services, actually helps restart conversations sometimes with the former employer who'd like to have that person back, but they kind of wrote them off because they went off and had to apply for benefits and haven't worked for them for a while.
Like the example of the person who gets cancer.
Correct. And that's a great example. People who are in car accidents, for example, that have spinal injuries, who might be able to become much more functioning after surgery and training and getting mobility back. There's lots of opportunities, and employers who invest all that time and energy in long-time employees, it would behoove them to keep track of those people, even though they aren't working for them any longer. Sometimes those employees are still on the employer's benefits, healthcare benefits, such as COBRA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a link there that we explore with our clients to see if they still have an open channel, so to speak, to that employer.
I want to turn to a caller now. Kevin in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
And I was the first vision impaired. I'm legally blind. I was the first actually disabled vision impaired, legally blind person to work for Time Warner Cable in the entire country. And I worked there for 9 years. One of the things that you have to understand, too, is that once you have that job, it's almost a fight to keep it. There were many times when they updated their software, and I used adaptive software called Zoom Text, which not only enlarges the screen, but also is a screen reader, which reads what's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
There are many times when you go in, I went in one day, they updated the database, and it didn't work. And so they had to call in what's called a script writer. There's only one or maybe two in the entire state of Ohio.
Hmm.
Had to wait for him to come in. It may take a week. Luckily, they kept me on, had me listen to phone calls, had me help other people, and paid me my full salary. They could have let me go. And eventually that's what happened, is the system just updated itself so much that the adaptives weren't updated along with it.
Mm.
And, that's not only a problem in the workplace, but at home. I've had, because everything moves so quickly in the past year, I've had multiple problems with like the Firefox browser. They keep updating it. And, there's no technical support for that. So
let me turn to Mary Dale Walters. I mean, Mary, is that a common refrain? I mean, you hear this a lot?
You can hear it a lot in organizations that aren't culturally aware and designed to support people with disabilities. I'm thinking of a specific instance at ALSEP where I was getting ready to hire a gentleman who had lost his vision over a period of 8 years, and my sister was blind, and so I kind of had a special awareness to people with vision problems.
Mm-hmm.
He came into the interview and brought his software and showed us basically how he would engage, and then we adapted our environment to fit him. But you're right, every time we change something in a proprietary system, his manager had to be there to say, hey, let's make sure that our guy can still access this. And when the systems changed to the point we couldn't adapt, we moved him into a different kind of job, and he was able to do that job. He's still with us after 8 years. He's probably in his third job with us. And in many ways, our technology continues to improve, and we use more off-the-shelf technology instead of proprietary technology, which often has some adaptive features to it. But it does take a big commitment for that company to, and that's a pretty big company, Time Warner, to make their own employees, their own managers aware that this is not an exclusion, that this should be inclusion, not exclusion.
Hmm. I'm wondering if it affects the dynamic or the equation when there are so few people, like Kevin, in the workforce at say a place like Time Warner.
It does. If people aren't, I'm going to use an ironic word. Mm-hmm. If people don't see people with disabilities mm-hmm. in their environment and they don't see how they contribute, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
And there is a perception I've seen in research that people with disabilities get a break, and other employees don't like that. But there's not a whole lot of research to really show that that's true.
Because so few people with disabilities
and those people
are in the
workforce. They work really hard because they want that job, and they want to prove, I can do this job. I have another personal example of a friend who has worked remotely for her company, which is one of the world's largest technology companies, and she has some mobility issues and can't really walk well. Well, after a couple of years, she finally went to a big international conference, and she said, I worry that people will judge me when they see that, hey, I have to have a wheelchair or a cane to navigate. And I'm like, you've already proved yourself to them. And when she came back, I asked her, and she said, no, they seemed a little surprised, but they already knew that I was good at my job, and I'd mm-hmm. been promoted a bunch of times, and I had helped them, and that my mobility didn't really matter. And it's because they learned that she was a skilled person with a lot of talent before they recognized, oh, she just happens to have a disability.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. My guest is Mary Dale Walter. She's Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications for Illinois-based ALSUP Employment Services. That's an employment network funded by the Social Security Administration to help people across the country and in Ohio find jobs, people who are disabled. We are talking about employment of people who are disabled today. If you have a story to tell, if you know someone, if you're disabled and you found a job, give us a call and tell us how it worked. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When the labor market tightens up, opportunities open up for largely marginalized groups, including people who are disabled. But in Ohio, the workforce still lags when it comes to employing people with disabilities. We're talking about employment opportunities and programs for people who are disabled. Still with us by phone is Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications for ALSUP Employment Services, Mary Dale Walters. ALSUP is an employment network funded by the Social Security Administration to help people across the country find jobs. Joining us is Scott Listener. He's the Americans with the Disabilities Act coordinator at Ohio State. He serves on numerous boards of organizations devoted to disability rights, including the Center for Disability Empowerment. Welcome back, Scott Listener.
Thank you.
Just over the years, since the Americans with Disability Act was enacted, signed into law in 1990, how has the role of technology helped or not when it comes to making accommodations and getting people into the workforce? Scott Listener?
So certainly technology has made some jobs much easier. Some of the things we think of as everyday and sometimes annoying technology started out as an accommodation, as an adaptive technology. Mm-hmm. So voice input menus, the modern keyboard to the typewriter was done to allow the typing pool to copy transcripts from wax cylinders mm-hmm. way back when. And so certainly computer technology, the improved design of physical space and office furniture has helped a lot with keeping employees productive, particularly as the workplace ages and particularly for individuals with sensory impairments of various sorts.
So what's the downside to that? The technology helps, but it also is at a faster than ever pace, changing and being updated, as I think Kevin from the Time Warner employee mentioned.
Yeah, so every time there's a new release, where if it's web-based, so the use of the web, which is, if designed well, accessible, but if designed without a lot of thought, not so accessible. New releases will sometimes break the access that was there, and we have to retool, figure out the right workaround, the right accommodation to make that work. When we think about the broad use of web technology and apps as infrastructure in employment these days. So it's pervasive. And the requirement that technology be accessible is a requirement on employers, not on the vendors of the technology. Mm-hmm. So there's no direct regulation for them to accommodate, software industry
yeah.
to create accessible software. It's market pressure for them. So typically, advancements come out, and then the groups of people who are working on building access into that come second, unfortunately, in a lot of the development process for technology.
Mary Dale Walters, is there, Scott is the ADA coordinator at Ohio State. Are there any lines of business, any fields out there that are better than others at welcoming people who are disabled?
I don't know the answer to that in any authoritative sense. I know that the people that ALSEP Employment Services gets back to work through the Ticket to Work program, they seem to be from a broad range of jobs, probably more office-based jobs, definitely technology jobs than, for example, construction sites.
Mm-hmm. And Scott Listener, Ohio State's a big place. Is there a sense about where more people fit in some places than others?
So the largest subset of – we have about 4.6% of our workforce, about 2,500 and a little over that employees – with disabilities who are receiving accommodations.
Right around the national average, right?
Who have come forward and disclosed. So we know we've got some that haven't. But these are folks receiving something. The largest subgroup in our standard employment categories is kind of administrative and professional jobs. Mm-hmm. The second largest subgroup is actually in like nursing and medical professionals. That's a very physical set of job demands. And so we get a lot of acquired disability with nurses. Who
okay, they become disabled on the job.
Yeah, lifting all those patients. And right. It's a very physical job. So that's a fairly large subset as well. But administrative would be the kind of largest single pool. And when I look at disability categories, chronic health, including mental health issues, is kind of our largest single subgroup. It's about 1.5% of the workforce, about a quarter of the individuals with disabilities have chronic health or mental health issues.
Either Mary Dale Walters or Scott Listener chime in, was the Americans with Disabilities Act written with the issues of developmental disabilities, intellectual/intellectual disabilities, and mental health disabilities in mind? Mary Dale Walters, how much does that involve you when you're looking for people for jobs?
Well, if you look at those who have Social Security disability benefits, which is the pool of potential employees that we work with, and you look at the top 10 types of disabilities people receive benefits for, number one is musculoskeletal. Probably two or three of the top 10 are disabilities that fall into the mental health category, particularly anxiety disorders and depression. If you look at the secondary diagnosis, even with primary diagnosis that are physical, so to speak, you'll find that depression is often the number one secondary diagnosis. It comes kind of part and parcel with severe physical disabilities.
It's like a comorbidity type of thing.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, I hear my own doctors talk about how people just get emotionally beaten down by the pain, the physical stress of just trying to manage through the back pain, the cancer treatment, the things that just take their toll on our body physically, also take their toll on our mind sometimes.
Right. Scott Listener, you find the same thing?
Much the same thing. The other toll that's there that wasn't mentioned is just the stigma and the extra time and effort it takes to get most everything done when you have a disability, figuring out how to get through the day and deal with the barriers in the environment is another toll on your mental health. The ADA was written kind of as a template free of particular diagnostic categories.
Okay.
You know, it talks about a substantial limitation to a major life activity. And in a way that would certainly include mental health issues, it includes developmental disabilities. If you kind of look historically over its almost 30 years, you know, kind of the first blush, everybody heard disability and thought wheelchair, thought blindness maybe as their second round. And over time, kind of the categories we have in our mind as exemplars of disability have expanded. And so certainly in our student population, as well as in our employment population over the last 3 to 5 years, that's become the largest demographic subgroup within disability has been mental health as a cluster of diagnoses.
Rose in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rose.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
So I did want to kind of speak out from the management perspective. I'm the manager of a retail location inside of Columbus, and I found a great resume the other day. I was super excited to schedule it. But when the person came in, I soon realized that they were deaf, which didn't impair our interview, and I was still really excited to get them on board. But after they left for the interview, I was kind of walking around the store trying to figure out how I would be able to make a good work environment for this individual. And I realized not only did I not have the tools available, I had no education on, you know, what counts as a reasonable work accommodation. It just wasn't something that I was prepared to do. Same thing happened with somebody else that I interviewed last year who was using a wheelchair. And then I had to look around and I was like, I couldn't even get them actually to the back office because we didn't have the space to do the interview. So we had to do it out on the floor. And it was really kind of eye-opening to me seeing we have, you know, all these people applying, but not only do we not have the tools in order to know what to do, we have no education as managers to figure out how we can get these people on the staff.
Yeah, Mary Dale Walters, what about that? And Scott Listener, I mean, Mary Dale Walters, what about how employers, how much are they expected to know?
Well, As I said, I've seen studies that would conclude that employers may not all the way down through their organizations really have given their, just as your caller is saying, their managers and their supervisors a clean and clear understanding of the ADA and how to go about accommodating and how to ensure you're not discriminating against those employees. I believe, and Scott can confirm, the ADA does not apply to certain size employers. So if you're trying to get a job with a really small organization, they may, in fact, not have to meet the criteria of the ADA.
And yet, smaller organizations are the ones that are, do the most hiring in this country.
So the ADA excludes employers with less than 15 full-time equivalent employees from mandated accommodations from its coverage. So, the assumption when it was being written is most of the firms that side, most of the businesses that side were essentially family businesses with family employees. And there is actually a lot of informal accommodation that takes place at that level because it's a tight family group, so to speak.
But are there any resources for someone like Rose to use to understand, you know, within their means, what can they do?
So one quick, easy referral I would make is the Job Accommodation Network. They're out of the University of West Virginia on a federal grant forever. You can go onto their site and search by disability, by type of employment, and get recommended accommodations as well as some information on their on the law, on your obligations under the law and whether or not you're covered. So that's a really useful tool that I use in training with managers and supervisors at OSU quite a bit and with our HR staff. If you're looking for other resources in your community, the local independent living center, so like the Center for Disability Empowerment here in Columbus, but there's a national network of state independent living councils, and every state has 3, 4, 5 kind of regional independent living centers. And that would be a good resource for an employer looking to see what is possible. And the EEOC actually, despite being the enforcement agency, and I will say about 85% of their complaint resolutions include an obligation to do training. So clearly training is an issue. But they also have a lot of good technical assistance material on their website that is worth taking a look at.
Mary Dale Walters?
Yes. We work with the Job Accommodation Network. We refer our clients to them, and they are considered an excellent resource. I would definitely reinforce what Scott said about them.
When a company, a smaller company like Rose is talking about, reaches out and tries to accommodate, are they then forced to follow through? Scott Listener?
So I'm going to try really hard not to pick on
– right.
So there's some obligation –
we can't afford that accommodation.
There's some obligation to thoughtfully think about it's beyond a reasonable accommodation. So accommodations, what you're obligated to provide is a reasonable accommodation. So reasonable doesn't have a fixed black and white checklist definition. But you can look at the cost burden, and if it is an undue burden compared to your resources as a business.
You're not.
So if you're a 25 staffed retail business, your resources are very different than if you're OSU. So OSU really can't say it's going to cost us too much money.
Right.
Because, we're, $3 billion budget or something like that. But a smaller business might reach an undue financial burden. Sometimes it's an undue administrative burden, just the practical realities of the accommodation don't work for the position.
Right. So Rose hires the person who is deaf and it doesn't work out. Is there any legal liability, Mary Dale Walters, for the employer if they say it's not working out, we're going to have to let you go?
I'm going to defer to Scott on that.
Okay, Scott, listener. I mean,
expert.
Is it a form of discrimination?
I will say there's an interesting definition of what is what is a necessary or critical job function inside an organization and how an organization defines that. Mm-hmm. But I will leave that answer to that to him.
Okay, Scott,
so,
listener.
So you know, there's some risk if you haven't done due diligence, if you haven't looked at the position and the potential accommodations and say, worked with the individual. It's supposed to be an interactive process. And said, how do we make this work? So I'm in a retail establishment and I have a deaf employee and all of my employees do some sales work and some stocking work and some folding and whatever else goes on in the store. So I might look at, you know, deafness isn't monolithic. Some people have some hearing, some people have less hearing. Mm-hmm. Some people read lips really well, some people read lips not at all. So, and some people are oral. It sounds like the employee your caller interviewed must have been oral, and probably a lip reader. So in a retail setting, if there's not if it's not the middle of Macy's but a smaller store, it's probably quiet enough and usually one-on-one that I suspect there are some ways to help make it work. There's some apps that you can use that will help identify. They don't do a great job of transcription, but they do a reasonably good job of letting you know someone's trying to get your attention and some of those things.
Rose, thanks for that call. We are going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll get to some more calls when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about employment opportunities and hiring programs for people who are disabled. So with us by phone, Senior Vice President of Strategic Communications for ALSUP Employment Services, Mary Dale Walters, also the Americans with Disabilities Act Coordinator at Ohio State, Scott Listener. I wanted to turn to a call real quick before we move on. Pam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Pam. Hello, Pam.
Hi, I'm here.
Okay,
it's
go ahead.
To be on the air. Yep. I had a hip replacement surgery several years ago and ended up with my right quadricep being paralyzed. And so I'm disabled and confined to a wheelchair now. But I was self-employed and I'm an attorney. So I was able to make accommodations. But they included having to move my office, which was quite expensive, and I had to hire movers. And when I went to my insurance to ask them to help pay for my mobility device, so that I could get back and forth to court, they said they only covered things to get around your home. They don't cover things to help you work. And I'm very frustrated by that. And I wondered if there were any resources available, because like I said, moving my office was to accommodate my disability. I did that. It was very expensive. You know, and I've encountered other expenses that I've had to cover. But I thought at least my insurance would cover.
Well, let's Scott Listener, what about that?
So something that OSU doesn't get to use very often, but that might have made sense for the caller, is there are some tax credits for small businesses and for larger businesses, making their businesses more accessible for their employees. I don't know of a reason that being self-employed makes you not eligible for that, but it's an ongoing tax credit under the IRS code. I don't have the site for that handy because I don't use it very much. And there are, again, it depends a little bit on your exact circumstances. Some of the, for us, our disability insurer that does our disability employment benefits will sometimes pay for pieces of adaptive equipment that are beyond what would be our obligation as a reasonable accommodation, but will allow their client to get back to work without having to pay ongoing, you know, ongoing support disability payments. And then here in Ohio, OOD, the Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities, if you are eligible and need a particular piece of equipment to do the job they've identified as an appropriate goal, they will sometimes fund adapting your car so you can drive, adaptive technology in a laptop that you can bring to work, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Mary Dale Walters, any added thoughts?
Scott mentioned all the things that came to my mind about those availability, especially the tax credits, ramps to get in your door, to actually hire people with certain types of, in certain categories with disabilities. We don't think about the tax laws having that opportunity, presenting that opportunity, but it does, and it does help the businesses.
Okay, Pam, I hope that helps. Thanks for your call. Joining us now is Carrie Jones. She's president and CEO of the Down Syndrome Association of Central Ohio. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Carrie, you have a sibling with a disability that's working through this as far as work is concerned. How's that gone? How's the process gone for him?
Well, Alex is 33 years old. He has Down syndrome, and he was fortunate in that he found his dream job right out of high school. And so he has worked there now for 17 years. So I think when you look at successful employment, you can look at the bare minimum and say he's been employed, which is a great goal, but certainly not our end goal for him. And so we've had different challenges over the years with his employer, and it's a large supermarket retailer in town. And so we've had issues that we face. Our family has rallied around Alex to make sure that he's getting the things he needs in order to do his job the best that he can. But he loves it, and ultimately we're going to support him because he loves his job.
Does he work full time?
He works 5 days a week, not full time, which is a challenge that I think many individuals with
it's a financial challenge,
face.
Right?
Yeah, and I think it's suspected in our community that doesn't make you benefit eligible to be full time, and that's a huge barrier that we continue to see. That, you know, I think we want to celebrate employers hiring people with disabilities, but we also want to push them to hire people at full-time status.
Full-time status, but for some people, they're not able to work full-time, but they want to work. What about that, Scott, listener, where the disability impedes the ability to work full-time and to benefit from those things? So I'm hypothetically, Alex, it's exhausting for, you know, I'm just saying hypothetically, maybe it's more than 4 or 5 hours a day is too much.
It could be, but I think we have to assume ability.
Ability.
We have to assume ability.
Try and first.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a common misconception that we have to kind of figure out how to tackle. I definitely agree. I mean, hey, I would love to not work full time.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
but I think we have to, you know, think about the abilities of people and really start with, you know, assuming that they can.
Yeah, because one of the reasons I work full time is because of benefits.
Right.
But so the ADA wouldn't expect you to take a full time job, wouldn't require you to take a full time job and make it significantly less than full time. Because of that drop in productivity, you wouldn't be doing the job, the essential job functions. Mm-hmm. But it also can give you an employer an umbrella to think about doing some job carving for that employee who can only work 20, 25, 30, 35 hours a week, not the full 40, or doing some job sharing. So we have some employees in our I'll pick on an example in my head, a young man that works in our library who is the world's best shelver.
Uh-huh.
He's delighted to do shelving. He enjoys doing shelving. He enjoys interacting with the other students and patrons of the library. And he's the world's best shelver. We don't have jobs that are you're hired to be a shelver as a standard job, but we were able to do a little bit of job carving under that umbrella of accommodation and collect the shelving duties that several higher level librarians were doing, who are equally delighted to never have to shelve a book. Right. So it was a win-win to be able to create those kinds of jobs. Right. And so I think you're right. We assume ability. If somebody applies for a full-time job, you don't automatically assume they can't do it because mm-hmm. they have a disability. That would be discrimination. But sometimes they come in knowing that they're looking for part-time work. And depending on your workforce, you may have part-time work or you may not.
You know, Mary Dia Walters, what are larger companies better at making doing those job carvings, or are medium size? You know, I'm assuming anything above the ADA requirements for size of company in this.
I think it's about the culture of the employer. Okay. They can make those decisions. They can accommodate as they need to. I think they have to be a little bit cautious about evaluating performance differently than a person who is not classified as disabled. They have to be fair on both sides of that fence, but they can create jobs that, as Scott was saying, would exist in the general workplace. In his case, his example, they've just really put that one guy into a job that three people were doing, and mm-hmm. that's a perfectly reasonable approach, I would think, for any of our particular clients. Since you ask about part-time, I'll add to that by saying that under the Social Security Disability System, if you're on SSI or SSDI, mm-hmm. you can work part-time and earn, in 2019, you can earn up to $1,220 a month. If I'm blind, I can earn up to $2,040 a month without jeopardizing my disability benefit.
Okay.
It's called substantial gainful activity. And so most of those are probably part-time jobs for people who can work a little bit. They want to keep their benefits. And in reference to the discussion about full-time versus part-time mm-hmm. and eligibility for benefits, a nice particular element of the Ticket to Work program that employment networks help you with for both the employer and the employee is if I'm on disability, I'm going to be eligible for Medicare even if I'm under the age of 65.
Mm-hmm.
My Medicare eligibility will stay with me for 93 months after I go back to work. So the employer doesn't have to worry about a perceived, whether it's real or not, I'm not sure, a perceived higher cost to insure that person. And the individual is insured they keep their Medicare benefits and don't have to worry about being eligible for the employer's plan.
Carrie Jones, from where you sit, you know, president and CEO of the Down Syndrome Association of Central Ohio, how have the opportunities changed over time? What's different? What's new?
I think that historically there have been jobs that are most available in the food industry, you know, grocery stores, that kind of thing. And that's really common, but not everybody wants to work at a grocery store mm-hmm. or in a restaurant. And so we're starting to see a shift. I think we can keep pushing, but we're starting to see a shift of other employers who have people working predominantly in office settings and things like that, looking at people and saying, okay, I think we need to diversify here.
You know, the sheltered workshop scenario has often been sort of putting one widget into another widget kind of a thing. There's an organization called PassionWorks out of Athens that is tapping into the creative abilities and really it seems like opening up a whole nother avenue that people tend to want to support. What's your thoughts about that?
I love, you know, my friends there.
PassionWorks, yeah.
PassionWorks is wonderful. And I think what I really appreciate about what they're doing is they're really actively working to sell the products that the individuals are creating, their artwork. They're very aggressively working to sell so that those individuals can earn a reasonable income. I've heard of other, you know, different types of programs where there are individuals creating the artwork and it's kind of touted, you know, they can sell their own artwork, but you'd have to come to their little, you know, to this corner of a shop, mm-hmm. you know, down the road, if you know where it is, in order to buy something and have them earn that income. So I think I really appreciate PassionWorks because they're aggressively working to sell products.
There's a lot more to talk about, but there's not a lot more time. I have to say thank you to Carrie Jones, President and CEO of the Down Syndrome Association of Central Ohio. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Also, Mary Dale Walters of the Illinois-based ALSEP Employment Services. That's an employment network funded by the Social Security Administration to help people across the country find jobs. Mary Dale Walters, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Scott Listener, he is the coordinator for Americans with Disabilities Act at Ohio State. Serves on many boards of organizations devoted to disability rights. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.